So I'm going to dive right in with that podcast that you did with Cameron Esposito. And I found it so moving. And one of the things that you said that I just mentioned was that when she asked about who your audience is, you said it's mostly queer people and progressive people. And the area that I live in, Northwest Florida, is not really known for embracing queer culture or for progressive politics. Most of the people listening right now or when this airs are probably straight, white, conservative leaning. And this is your opportunity to invite those people to the table. So what do you say?
Oh, wow. you know, I think that, gosh, what do I say? That's a hard one because I'm trying to think of my own relatives right now and thinking, how would I get them to come? I mean, I think that they'd come just out of curiosity if I promised not to say the F word at all. But, you know, I think that whatever you believe, you don't want that belief to be strengthened by having no exposure to other beliefs. You know, if you feel solid in what you believe, and then good to expose yourself to the opinions of other people, and then you can know if you feel really solid in that belief you hold, or if you're somebody whose, you know, mind is willing to change. And I've noticed as I've gotten older that that I feel much more interested in my own curiosity and in wonder more so than rightness and knowing and certainty. And I think that things like that can often, you know, stifle not just our own learning, but also our own joy. And I think the way, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but, you know, even if a dog has a really big yard, say it lives on a farm, and the dog starts to get depressed after a while because it hasn't seen new things, and it would be happier if, you know, it went for a half a mile walk than it would be maybe running around the same place. So I don't think people put enough value on or enough attention on how important it is for, you know, just our own well-being to be exposed to new things and to be willing to be rattled by what in us is capable of changing.
I'm going to come back to that theme of change, but just to get into the meat of what you're coming to UWF for is you're giving a keynote address at the annual Women's Studies Conference. So tell me a little bit about what you plan to discuss.
I plan to discuss queerness. I plan to discuss feminism. I plan to discuss, you know, our vibrance, our joy, our despair. I'm talking a lot about, you know, grief and sort of leaning into the grief and to not be afraid of it. Also the idea of like taking turns giving up. I've been thinking about that a lot since the most recent election. That was just, it was so heartbreaking. And I didn't know so much despair, political despair, as I did after that. And then I started thinking, you know, I can have days where I give up. And I think the key to it is just taking time to give up on a different day than, for example, my partner gives up or my best friend. And, you know, just taking turns with all of it and allowing all of those feelings to be moving us forward and to not be afraid of feelings that we think might be holding us back, you know, the rage or the terror and all of that, to just feel into it. I'm a lot about feelings.
Yeah. So when you're saying, you use these as umbrella terms, but I want to dive in just a tiny bit, that you're going to be talking about queerness and feminism. And I think the people who are maybe already registered for the conference know what those umbrella terms mean. In a few, if you were to give a little bit more, what does that mean to you, queerness, and then separately feminism?
Yeah. You know, I've been asked that before, and I think Something that's wonderful about queerness is I don't know that it can be defined or it's different for every individual, but for me, it speaks in terms of maybe where I live in terms of my gender, my sexuality. I date women. My gender is, I identify as genderqueer, non-binary, meaning that I've never really felt like a man or a woman throughout my entire life, and neither of those have really resonated with me. And queerness is, I think, just a lens that I have on the world. My thinking in terms of like queering everything. For example, the way that I write a poem, trying to think wildly outside of the box. Even my writing process, I think, is queer in that I've never known somebody else that writes in a particular way that I do, where I write focused on sound, and I know the sound of a poem before I know the words, and it's just widening my lens outside of the boxes that were prescribed to me when I was young, and everything in the culture that's saying this is the way to do it, and being willing to think and feel outside of that to explore who I am and who I am in relation to other people. And feminism, I forget who said it, but feminism is the radical idea that women are people. But, I talk a lot in my writing about patriarchy and sort of dismantling the norms of how, like a cis white man is the normal human of society, and everything else is like a fall off from that, which is just not true. But in the perception of culture, we're creating a world that is, or we continue to create a world that is that. But a lot has sort of been tearing that down lately. I've been really inspired by the Me Too movement, for example, and I'll also be speaking about that.
That kind of segues into the next thing I wanted to ask you about is that on Saturday you're going to be giving a workshop on gender theory, and that's pretty broad. Yeah. What do you hope to cover, and who should come?
I mean, anybody who loves writing or loves learning new things, or anybody that's fascinated or interested in gender, or anybody who thinks that they aren't at all. In the workshop, essentially, we'll be talking about, I'll be exploring the art of, some contemporary spoken word artists and using who are speaking specifically about gender. And we'll use those poems as prompts for writing and discussion. And the discussions can be really fun, and they can be even more fun. For example, if somebody comes and they're, they have wildly different opinions than I do, because I think that those are the conversations that are needing to be had. And I think that we shy away from them because, they can be scary and they can be really vulnerable spaces for people who that conversation affects directly. But we have conversations, and then people get a chance to write from a prompt that I'll give on each poem. And it's really exciting because people who don't identify as writers often are the majority of the workshop are typically people who aren't commonly writing poetry. So it's really exciting for me to see what comes out of people and watching people finding themselves. It's not that I ever know who I am and then I write it down. I learn who I am through the process of writing. So I like watching other people have that experience as well.
That sounds wonderful. Also connected, you brought this up before, that you use they, them pronouns, and a lot of people maybe don't understand that request, or maybe don't even understand the concept of gender nonconformity or being genderqueer. Help us understand.
When I was young, I identified as a tomboy, and it wasn't until maybe, 12 years ago, I think somebody said the word genderqueer to me for the first time. And up until that point, I had never even, I'd never been given the language, or I never knew of I just never considered that there was a space you could live in terms of gender outside of the binary. And Leslie Feinberg, who was an activist and writer who I adored, Leslie said that, you know, gender is the poetry each of us makes with the language that we've been given or the language that we've been taught. And I love that because in connection with poetry, the more language that you get, the more you can learn yourself and know yourself. As soon as I heard the word genderqueer, I thought, wow, that feels like it fits. And then several years later, it started being more common in culture for people to use a pronoun other than he or she to, you know, match their non-binary identity. And when I started using that pronoun, I just felt much more relaxed in myself. And neither of the other pronouns ever really felt like they fit. And, it just felt like somebody saying my name right for the first time or hearing my name correctly. And I could feel a part of me relax. But I know that it can be a difficult concept for people to get their heads around at first, and it also can be like a really sweet learning process for people. You know, my partner's mother sent us mugs for Christmas this year that said she for my partner's mug, and then mine said theirs, and it was really sweet for us to, you know, sort of watch family catching up to it all, and making mistakes along the way of learning how to use it, you know, use that word in a sentence, for example. It can be tricky for people at first, but it's easier once you commit to, you know, really getting it down.
I'm going to pivot really quick and say that you're on a pretty long tour now and a fairly long career already. Does what you have to say feel different in 2018?
You know, it really does. it does for me. You know, I was working on a project entirely about love right before the election, and when Trump got elected, it was really important to me to be speaking directly to, you know, what's happening in our world right now. And so I didn't, there's a ton of love in whatever I'm putting out. I think that sadly love is political in its own ways, but when you're talking, you know, when I'm writing a love poem about a woman, but I feel, I'm having to constantly just let myself know there's more time than I think. I've already finished my next two books, for example. And so I've never been paced like this before in terms of how much I'm wanting to create, how much I'm wanting to put out. And there just feels like so much to say and so much to do. And there is so much to say and so much to do. But I'm also trying to find some, you know, peace and joy in the mix of that. Because initially that was really hard for me to find right after the election. I was living in a pretty consistent place of heartbreak.
Yeah. So I reached out to a couple of friends who love your work and asked them what they would ask you. And my friend Ileana wants to know what advice you would give young Andrea at 8, at 14, at 21.
At 8, at 14, at 21. Wow. Those are some hard ages. I have a niece who's 13 right now, and I was thinking, God, that age is so painful. You know, of all the advice that I've been thinking about, and it's still the same advice that I think is most important to give myself at the age I am now. I wish that when we were young, there was some real investment in teaching children to have a really kind relationship with themselves. And when I think of all of those years, I think that would be the primary thing that I would invest in talking about is just nurturing the relationship that you have with yourself, because the kinder we are to ourselves, the more forgiving we are to ourselves. I feel like everything else just kind of falls in place, and falls in place how kind we are to other people, how invested we are in creating a kinder world. And I think of those ages, and that's the most important thing, because, you know, whether it was a time when I was being bullied or it was a time where I was you know, terrified to just welcome the whole of myself and to be tender with the whole of myself and compassionate. And yeah, that's everything I can think, you know, every problem I can think of that I've had in my life. One of the most, one of the things that I think about is how could I have been more tender with myself?
I once asked a friend when I was in college and we were sitting in a study area or something, and I turned to her and I was just like, do you ever feel like if people knew all the feelings you had, it would scare them? And she looked at me like I was completely nuts. And now they have this word, extra. I have always been what the kids say, extra. And I get the feeling that you fit that bill too. A time when you fought that? How did you learn to embrace it?
You know, there was a time when I was in high school. I think I went a period in high school where I was, you know, 3 years maybe, where I don't think that I cried one time. But I think that was a response to having been an extra child and just trying to protect myself. After that, I think the first time I fell in love with a woman, I guess I was about 19, it all just sort of cracked off of me. There was no more trying not to cry. And that was just, it was a hard time for me and also a really beautiful time for me. And I just, all the shell, every piece of shell I had just fell off. And so I've been extra ever since. And sometimes, you know, sometimes that is the thing that I need kindness towards myself around. And because, you know, I'll think this is too much. Even though in my poems I'll be saying things, you know, like my poems, I'm not necessarily already there. It's like I'll try to write the poem, write where I want to be, and then try to follow the poem, or my life follows the poem in that direction. I'm just always going to be extra, and I'm just trying to build some kindness towards myself around that when it seems like it's one of those days where, gosh, Shader, come on, it's been all day. And yes, it's been all day, and maybe it's going to be all day tomorrow too.
You just released a new book and a new album.
And
one of the things that you address is how love can change us, might be the only thing that can change us. You talk about change and how it seems like the figure of the lover you address inspires change. And then the tension between change that you want for yourself, change that someone else inspires in you, and sort of how someone else seeing you can inspire that change, make you want it for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a poem, which may be part of what you're talking about. There's a poem called Hey Galaxy. I don't know if that's what you're talking about. But just to speak on the topic broadly, I think that wanting change in ourselves comes from that love relationship that we have with ourselves. I don't think that wanting to change when it's inspired by maybe shame about who we are is actually going to create much change in us. I don't think that shame does anything good. I've tried to get my head around it doing something good somewhere, but I really don't think it ever does. I don't think it ever leads people to being better people, and it certainly hasn't been the diving board for me in that arena. Any time that I can be really good to myself, then I'm much more likely to become a better person. And I speak about love a lot, and not just romantic love, but, you know, love with our friends, love for community, as being sort of, a ladder towards our highest selves. And I think that love relationships are like classrooms where we are growing and learning and expanding. And so I think it's important to pay attention to the kind of people that you have around you, because they're ultimately a large part of what's going to be pulling you into your wisest self.
And then the other thing that you discuss are your experiences of anxiety, panic, depression, fear. And I was struck by the paradox.
I think a lot about that.
Well, it seemed like a paradox to me that those are wells of pain, but also wells of strength. And I wanted to know how you navigate that. And the line that stuck out there was, you don't want a soft death. You want a hard life. That is your life.
So, you know, I write a lot about anxiety, and still to this day, I have a relationship with performing that is like no one else's that I personally know. It's a terrifying thing for me. It's always been that way. And, you know, and it's not just like it's the only terrifying thing. I've written poems about, you know, I write a lot about anxiety and panic, and I have a lot of fear in my life. But I feel grateful that there's been something in me that has, I don't know if it's necessarily pushed through, but, I mean, you know, made friends with. And so nothing has really gotten less scary. I've just, in some ways, made friends with the fear, or try to be gentle with myself through it. And so I write a lot about that. I also write a lot about, and also in that, I feel like from, you know, my anxiety and panic has come discovering maybe the bravest parts of myself, because, you know, sometimes something that wouldn't be scary to anybody, you know, to other people, I'll see something, it will look like a tsunami on the horizon, and that's how it will feel inside of me. It will feel that big. And to consistently be pushing through that, I think has, you know, built some of my, you know, my character or my drive to live. And the same with other things, depression, suicidality. I've struggled at different times in my life to a want to stay alive. And some of that has been related to, I have a chronic illness. And so during periods when I've been really sick, that's been the times when it's been most difficult for me to, you know, gather the will. But also through that, the continuous gathering of will, and then seeing, you know, the light or the beauty that might be on the other side of that is sort of, in some ways, you know, made me who I am. Not to say that we can't be wholly made by joy, because I think we can be made by anything. It's just the lens that we put on it.
Is there anything else you want to say to your potential audience coming up here?
Excited to come, and I can't wait. And thank you so much for your open ears today.
Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.